The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
Well, good morning, everyone. It's nice to have a full Zendo this morning for the beginning of Ango, and welcome to all of you who are joining us from wherever you are. I spoke this morning at the end of the, before we lifted silence at this weekend session, of the importance of these practice traditions that have come down to us over the centuries. And they changed the form somewhat, so the Buddha responding to not just the needs of the Sangha and the Dharma, but the environment, the climate, the weather, the realities of his time, established this practice because of the regularity of the rainy seasons in India. And then how that providing, as we look back and understand what they did during those seasons, how that was taken up and continued beyond that particular time and place, because it was seen as valuable to the Sangha to have this period of intensified training where the Sangha would come together and practice together earnestly. And so traditionally in China and in Japan, that monastics would travel to different training monasteries where they wanted to spend the Ango, often to study with a particular teacher, study at a particular monastery. And so they would cloister themselves there for that period of time, engage in Ango. In fact, Dogen has a fascicle. It's the longest fascicle of the Shobogenzo on Ango. And the first part of it is Dharma, teaching. And the second, middle, long part of it is the procedure for how to do what we just did this morning. If we did it exactly how he did it, we would miss lunch, I think. So, on the chart in the back, the center is Jewel Mirror Samadhi, which is the mind that we're cultivating, the mind of a mirror that perfectly reflects, sees whatever comes before it without prejudice or bias. Even when there's dust on the mirror itself is unaffected. And so that bright, luminous mind, Buddha mind, that we all possess. And then in the four quadrants, origination, the Buddha spoke of origin, the origin of our suffering, the whole mass of suffering, he said, as being our delusion. But we could also think in terms of origination as the beginning. Here, we begin at the beginning. We, as practitioners, those of us who consider ourselves practitioners, we had a beginning, some sort of clear, cogent beginning of this path from which arises from our suffering, from our desire to alleviate that. And then we go forward and we need virtue in the second quadrant. Virtue in Buddhism is practicing in accord with not just the Buddhist moral teachings, but our own fundamental sense of right and wrong, our own fundamental sense of what is true and what is not true, good and what is not good. And so we practice the Buddha way, developing our minds, opening our hearts in compassion, calming those energies and forces within us that would do harm. And because it's a long path, we need perseverance. The third quadrant, we have to cultivate stability, constancy. Dada Roshi used to say it's a practice not for sprinters, right, who can have a great burst of energy, but then are exhausted quickly. That rather it needs to have great energy, but to be sustained over time. So there's perseverance. And then there's attainment. Having faith in the teachings, we practice and we verify what is true. We see through into what is not true. And then we're back to origination again. Having raised bodhicitta, having practiced, affirmed the faith that we have well placed, Now we begin again. We raise bodhicitta again, and we begin on this next stage of our practice. And so that's how the path unfolds. So we are gathered here this morning, a great ocean gathering, where two or more gather to practice Buddha Dharma. We call that a Sangha treasure. And there are all kinds of gatherings, families, friends, sports, governing halls for lectures and so on, for entertainment. But a Sangha is a gathering of those who have a way-seeking mind, who are raising bodhicitta, who are practicing the moral teachings, who have looked out and looked within at this landscape of samsara, right? This perennial inclination that we have as human beings to cause trouble and harm, chaos and confusion, and that it originates from within ourselves, but then we bring it out into the world, we flick it on others. And so this ocean gathering is of people who have seen that. We ourselves have participated in it and do not accept that. Do not accept it as the only viable path, the only way to live this life. We must accept it as the reality that we have in front of us and within us, but do not acquiesce to it. Do not actively participate and perpetuate and then pass that on to others in the next generation. So it's a different kind of gathering. And it's not just a gathering of well-wishers and dreamers, and wouldn't it be lovely, but of actual practitioners. That's the heart of the matter. And so we gather here today to initiate a practice period. We should never underestimate the importance of that. That is otherwise it's a philosophy, right? Otherwise it's, you know, it's like a table coffee book. It's nice to look at, lovely pictures, doesn't change any lives. So Dogen said in his fascicle on the Ango, he said, to train constantly throughout one's life, eating meals, sleeping, stretching your legs, this requires ongoing support. The structure of the 90-day practice period provides this very support. It is the head and face of the Buddhas and ancestors. It has been transmitted as their skin, flesh, bones, and marrow. And as I said this morning, it's been transmitted like this. It's been transmitted by people doing that very thing. And so he says, see the whole of the Ango from top to bottom, the practice period, as nothing but Buddha, Buddha mind, Buddha activity. It covers the 10 directions, in other words, to make it spread out within our whole lives, to let it permeate our minds. This is the great strength and transformative aspect of Buddhist practice. It's also the challenge, right? Because our conditioned mind bifurcates, divides, segments, creates categories, turns things off and on, sees things in all of these separated factions, right? And so we tend to see practice. So I practice and then I don't. I practice and then I don't. I turn it on and I turn it off. I'm inside of it and I'm outside of it. This is practice, this is not practice. I mean, that's just the mind we have the potential for and grow up in and see the world as. And so we're trying to really shift that and see the whole of a life, the whole of our lives, as a path. And again, not as poetry, not as, wow, that sounds great. Let's talk about it. Dogen said, don't comment on it. Just practice it. One of the nice things about Ango, I was thinking about cycles. You know, how these natural cycles that we live within the midst of. So we're here at in the last whispers of summer. Delicious. And we're sensing changing of light, of air, right? The mountain, the trees, the invasives. They're all showing the signs of a summer that is waning, right? They're four elements are beginning to pull back. just like when we begin to die. Our four elements are beginning to wither, right? The colors are changing, just starting, these whispers of the end of autumn, of summer and the beginning of autumn. And then that will bring us into winter, a quieter season, and then again into the spring, a bursting season. So these beautiful cycles, we have these cycles in our own lives. We're born, we're babies, infants, we're toddlers, we're adolescents, we're young adults. We grow into full adulthood, and then we begin a more active, obvious, tangible aging process towards the end of our life. We could think of a path. The path that we're on is having these cycles. I spoke about them in terms of how they're depicted on the chart, but we sense that something about our lives, there's more. We look around, we see our examples, we see what society and culture offers, and we enter into that, engage in that as we want and as we need to, but there's this strange sense that there's more, and that seems to be quintessentially human and primordial. I have to believe that it exists with every person, and in every person's life, it shows up like a bubble, but it's not always responded to. It's not responded to often enough. It's very easy just to glance and move forward. How many times have I heard a person in their 60s or 70s tell me the story of how they came to the Dharma when they were in their 20s? They felt so drawn to it, but then they had to get realistic and go about the business of their life as though they were two different things. And so we seek, if we're lucky, we encounter the Dharma, we raise bodhicitta, we enter the way, we train, and then that cycle continues, as I spoke about, like a spiral. And in our own training, and so we have these cycles, spring and fall, we do ango, summers and winters are a little bit lighter. For residents, every week we have a training week, and then at the end of, after lunch today, we go into hosan, which we continue to practice, and we're still in a training mind, but the schedule is lifted, and that has a whole host of purposes, right? Some very practical and some very deeply dharmic. And then we begin a new week again, train again. So there are all of these cycles taking place. And so it sort of brings us into sync with the cycles of Earth, the seasons, the planets, the moon. And it also helps to keep us lively, right? Because it's hard to sustain something continuously if it doesn't shift, right? If there's a certain kind of tenor to something and it always remains the same, then we begin to dull to that. We begin to kind of go numb to that. And so these cycles are also about keeping our spirits up, keeping them lively, rejuvenating. And so there's a leaning forward, an intensity of ango, and then there's a slight relaxation in the winter and summer, and then we lean forward again, and that helps us to renew. If we did ango 12 months out of the year, it wouldn't work. We could continue doing the schedule, but it would become dull, right? It's even been brought up as a program, why don't we do more sessions? Because they're often, you know, a waiting list. I said, if we do too much session, particularly the residents will start to get numb to it. You know, it's really important that we be alive at the beginning. So during this ango, the theme will be Dogen's Genjo Koan, which I'll speak about in a moment. But I want to say just a little bit about the Shobo Genzo. The first Taisho I ever heard Maizumi Roshi, Daito Roshi's root teacher, give was here in the Zendo. I was doing a session. First or second session I'd done. I wasn't living here yet. And he gave a talk on Shobo Genzo. The whole talk was just on the word Shobo Genzo. I had no idea what he was talking about. What is a Shobo Genzo? I thought. Anyway, so I kept having the feeling, what you're saying sounds very profound, but I have no idea what you're talking about. So, the Soto Shu, the Soto school, coming from Japan, began a translation project some years ago where they gathered together a group of scholars and began a translation of the entire Shobogenzo, which is 90 some odd fascicles and some appendices. And just, it's a brilliant piece of work. It took a long time. It's a daunting work because those of you who are familiar with Dogen's teaching know that it can be very difficult. And so I just wanted to read a little bit from the introduction because it, I think, helps us to appreciate some things that we might not be aware of in terms of Dogen. It says, in 1252, Japanese Zen master Dogen completed the final ordering and revisions of his life work. So Shobogenzo is the collection of this compilation of these teishos that he had given over years of his life and had bequeathed to us. Shobogenzo means the treasury of the true Dharma eye. And William Botiford, the author of the introduction, says, it was and is an audacious title. In the Chinese Buddhist literature of this time, the words treasury of the true Dharma eye signified the very essence, the eye of reality, the truth taught by the Buddha, the ability to perceive that truth, to realize it, the literature and lineage of the Buddhist teachers who perceive, teach, and convey that truth. In short, it's a title that promises to present the entire religious basis of Buddhism. Moreover, one of the leading and most influential Buddhist teachers in China had already used that title for a piece of their work. So Dogen's title, therefore, invited comparison with a very powerful predecessor. So we have to think back to this time in the 1200s when he was writing this in Japan. And Botiford says, this is a comparison that would not be to his advantage. Now, we think of Dogen as this really, large figure, right, within Buddhism, within Zen. But Botiford said, at his time, Dogen was neither influential nor a leading figure in Japan, much less in China. True, as a scion of an unnamed aristocratic family, he came from some aristocracy. He did not lack political connections for that reason. And he had gained some local fame for having traveled to China, where he studied with his teacher, Zhu Jing, and brought this lineage back to Japan. He said the intelligentsia of that time probably could recognize his name, but no more than that. In fact, it was much worse. He had never served as abbot of a major temple in the civilized center of Japan. Instead, he dwelled in a remote area far removed from the circles of power and cultural production. His death the following year, 1253, was not noted in the diaries of any contemporary aristocrats or historians. His writings did not circulate beyond the reaches of his immediate disciples. He and his writings, as was the case for so many of his contemporaries, easily could have been forgotten and lost. Interesting. And he was not seeking fame and power. If he had, he wouldn't have gone to the hinterlands, the mountains of Japan, far away from the cultural and power centers, to build his monastery. He goes on to say, today, Dogen Shobogenzo has become the most often read, cited, and studied literary work of Japanese Buddhism. And this is across lineages and schools of Japanese Buddhism. It firmly links modern Soto religious identity to the Buddhist traditions of China while situating it within a distinctive Japanese milieu. Because Dogen had to bring this Chan Chinese lineage and tradition, and then bring it into the time and culture and language of his time, which was Japan, medieval Japan. And then he goes on to talk about all of the valuable aspects of the Shobogenzo in terms of, particularly for scholars, in terms of giving them a window into what was going on in the monastic lives and monasteries of 13th century China. In terms of linguistics, it preserves a unique trove of evidence regarding the processes by which medieval Japanese language accommodated and gave new expression to Chinese idioms and wit. And he goes on to say more. He said, its condemnation of all forms of narrow-mindedness and rejection of gender discrimination inspires us today. The way he brought in so many Zen stories, the way he integrated the koans from the koan tradition of Zen in very unique ways, the way he incorporated and integrated fundamental Buddhist teachings, but in ways that were not didactic. You know, he didn't say, okay, now I'm going to teach on dependent origination, or now I'm going to teach, you know, invoke the four immeasurables. He just did it. He just presented it, like fully integrated, embodied. And so it's easy to miss those aspects, but they're there. And then finally he says, this work has achieved this great prestige in spite of, or maybe because of, the many difficulties it presents to readers and to translators. He says, sometimes passages from the Shobogenzo present us with a Rorschach test inkblot of language that can be parsed into multiple ways depending on the background and predispositions of its readers. So if you look at the different translations of the Shobogenzo, they can be quite different. In addition to the fundamental inherent complexity of its core subject matter, that is, the true nature of existence and our proper role within it, so the subject itself is complex, difficult. He says, but in addition to that, the Shobogenzo suffers from the same kinds of problems that plague almost all ancient writings. It comes from a time and a culture and a society very different from our own. It is expressed in a language that people today, including native speaking speakers of Japanese, cannot understand without lengthy study and the aid of many specialized reference materials. And some of our students, Hobai, Kondo, who in the earlier years of Shobogenzo retreats would offer their own translations, and they would, to those retreats, bring these massive reference books, right, that Bodiford is referring to here. He says, its textual history and manuscript traditions have eluded our understanding, while scholars have proposed contradictory or even untenable theories about them. Most of all, the Shobogenzo has not been served well by the somewhat haphazard ways that its several surviving manuscript versions were compiled and edited for publication. And then he goes on to talk about how they took on this project. And I just thought it was interesting to sort of get an inside view from the translators, these scholars, about the challenges that they were facing just to translate, right? Because they're not just translating, it's not like a, you know, like a manual for building a bicycle or something that's being translated into a different language. But they're translating the most difficult and profound ideas and concepts and words about the nature of existence, the nature of human mind, and suffering and liberation, that language really is extremely limited in the best of times to be able to communicate, because at its essence, it's trying to communicate something that is by its nature inexpressible. So how is that possible, right? And so for those of us who study the Shobogenzo, and from my own experience, particularly in the beginning, suffered from that study, right? Dogen's writing can be extremely difficult, right? Because of what he's talking about and then how he talks about it. He loved poetry. He was writing complex Chinese poetry when he was like 5, right? So he had this brilliant mind. And so he brought all of that to bear, and he was deeply realized, so he brought all of that to bear within his teachings. And here we are now, taking up this one particular fascicle, the Genjo Koan. And this fascicle is one of the great sort of luminous writings, teachings of his. It was, I believe, his first fascicle. It was written to a lay student. This must have been one hell of a lay student, because it's a very profound teaching. Genjo Koan, Maizumi Roshi translated as the way of everyday life. Genjo means that which is settled, which is immediately apparent. And koan was traditionally used to refer to like a legal case that's settled. And so it's been translated as the realized koan, the way of everyday life, actualizing the fundamental point, manifesting suchness, the realized law of the universe, manifesting absolute reality, the issue at hand, the actualization of enlightenment. That's just the title of the piece. So this is what we're going to be taking up in depth during the Ango, and I'll say a little bit more about that. So Kiju, I asked Kiju last year when I was in July, and when I was in New Zealand during in July, if he would be the chief disciple. He has been an important part of the New Zealand Sangha, which has been an important part of our Sangha for many years. Dada Roshi first went in 1988 to do the first sessions there, and we've been going essentially every year, minus 1 or 2 years during COVID. And once he couldn't take that trip anymore, it's a long trip, I began going. Hogen Sensei goes still regularly. Hogen Sensei went for many years and now has pulled back from that. And it is a very vibrant sangha. They have groups, about six affiliate groups all throughout the country, the two islands. They have, they're incorporated as a non-for-profit. They have, once a year, we have a board meeting so they can conduct business. They as a community-owned property in Christchurch, which is where Kiju lives, in which there is a living place so they can generate some income, and the other part of it is a zendo. So it's a permanent zendo, you know, as permanent as things are, for the Sangha, where they offer ongoing practice and retreats and also let other groups use it. So it's a very vibrant Sangha and has been over all these many years, and Kiju has been a very active part of that. Kaido, as many of you know, the other senior there, became a senior years ago and she was only able to spend 1 month here, which is still a big deal for her, and we're fortunate because Kiju has been able to, because of his work responsibilities, able to spend the whole of Ango here, so that's very nice. And so during the Ango, and so the chief disciple, as I said, is to provide an example. He takes his seat here, and that is said to hearken back to when the Buddha, in authorizing or empowering Mahakashyapa, one of his senior disciples, to teach, moved over and shared his seat with that disciple. So this is a way of sort of maintaining that. And so during the course of the Ango, we intensify our training, and so many of you who are participating in the Ango have thought about how you want to engage in the Ango, engage in the different areas of training in terms of how to intensify your Zazen practice, how to engage in your study. Hogen Sensei provided us with a wonderful art practice work during the Ango. I'll be giving Teisho on the Genjo Koan, so I'm going to be using Maizumi Roshi's commentary. Years ago, when Dada Roshi was studying at ZCLA, Maizumi Roshi did a translation and made commentaries on the Shobo Genzo, which is a tradition going back to the Buddha, where a teaching would be given, and then a teacher would give commentaries on that teaching to kind of provide us as students a way to enter into it and understand, because teachings are oftentimes very condensed, very dense. And so they presuppose understanding about Buddhist language and Buddhist concepts so that in the teaching, they don't have to do all of that, right? The teaching can just go right to the heart of the matter. And so it's very cogent, very succinct. But that can also make it very difficult, right? If the student isn't familiar with those teachings, because oftentimes they're not even named. You know, again, it's not like, now I'm teaching about dependent origination. It's just a teaching that assumes the student understands that teaching and can therefore understand what is being said now. And so these commentaries are really important, an important part of our study. So Maizumi Roshi did one, and Dada Roshi offered a photographic kind of capping verses, these photographs that sort of presented aspects of the Dharma points that Maizumi Roshi was making. And so that was a book that was published. I don't know if it's still in print. I looked and I couldn't find copies available. I have one. I think some of you might have one. I contacted Dharmajoy, one of the abbots at ZCLA, and I said, hey, we're going to do this. Is it okay if we can do this? I said, sure. Have at it. And so we're going to be using Mazumi Roshi's commentary. And I thought that was very nice because as we're celebrating our 45th anniversary, I really have been thinking a lot about how to center that within this teaching, which was so important to Dada Roshi, was such an important part of his teachings, which means it was a very important part of for us, many of us who studied with him. And it was an important way in which he studied with his teacher. And in that way, it goes all the way back to Dogen. And because Dogen was teaching Buddha Dharma, it goes all the way back to the Buddha. And so in that way, it helps us to really bring forth lineage, right? This living link that we have with people, with teachers and human beings going all the way back to the Buddha. And so I wanted to use Mazumi Roshi's commentary in that way. So I'll be doing Teisho on his different commentaries. The teachers will take some turns and do some mandos during the ango. I've asked the seniors to volunteer to take up practice, a kind of a mando with students during each month of the ango. And so there they've are going to be talking about different things that have to do with the way of everyday life. Relationships, work, money, you know, the stuff that everybody has to deal with and live within, and then practice. How do you practice those things, right? How do we merge or see the non-duality between sacred and mundane and do that in a real way? And so the seniors are going to be offering discussions, and I really hope that and invite the whole Sangha to participate. That'll be done online. And then, of course, we'll be doing our sessions and ongoing training. Those of you at home, you know, think about it. So we begin Ango today. So tomorrow morning when you wake up, how is tomorrow morning different? Right? How do you wake up and have a sense that you're in the midst of a training period with all of us together? That we're doing this together in different places, but we're doing practicing one Dharma, essentially taking up one practice, and we're doing that together. So, but how do you do that from within the solitude of your own place? Right? So try to really make that, bring that to mind, make it intentional. That's the whole point of, you know, thinking about it in advance when we send out, you know, the paperwork, right? To think about and reflect on various forms of training. What are you going to be doing? Hojin Sensei's art practice is really taking up the challenge of dualities, right? And so the art practice is to really sort of think about, reflect on any duality, you know, right and wrong, good and bad, sacred and mundane, mind and body. And as she said, this is a good time to do that because we're living in a time that is manufacturing false dualities. I mean, in a sense, all dualities have a falseness when we believe that they exist as absolute realities, that they are solid and distinct. So all dualities are false in that way, but many dualities are helpful. Right? There needs to be a boundary between the student and the teacher. We need to understand what that. You know, if the parent does not understand their role in relationship to the child, that's not going to go well, right? So there are dualities that are meaningful, right? It's when we impute into them significance and meaning and realities that they don't possess that we run into trouble. But then there are patently false dualities that are manufactured. And they're always manufactured at the expense of someone or some group of people for the supposed benefit of others, which means they are born out of the desire to cause harm. That may not, there's usually not their stated purpose, but it is their function. And so we're in a time where those dualities are being manufactured every day. and they are deceptive, and they are false, and they are injurious, they are causing harm, they are in many ways cruel. And so to really take that up in a different kind of way, right? Like, how can that possibly come into an art practice, right? Because the principle, whether it's a healthy duality, well-held, or whether it's a painful, suffering duality, the basic stuff of it is the same. How do we see it? How do we understand it? How do we engage it? And how do we do that in this way? Through creative expression, right? That's quite a feast. We will be celebrating our 45th anniversary in October. You know, I was thinking about how, in terms of these practice traditions, I don't know actually when the first Ango happened here. I have a list of all of the Shusos, the chief disciples, going back and with as few holes as I, because the record keeping in the early years was not great. Sort of like in the beginning of Buddhism, right? So I had to patch some holes and try and figure some things out. But I have a list. It's quite long. And but I don't know when the first Ango was. I suspect that it was in the first year or two. And once it began, it continued unbroken until COVID. No, actually, even through COVID. We did Angos during COVID, but we just did them here in Cloister. And everybody who wasn't here in residence, which was most of the Sangha, did them from home. And I was thinking about, in 2009, in the fall of 2009, Dada Roshi began that fall Ango. Kyusan was the chief disciple. And 5 weeks later, Dada Roshi passed away. So it just conveys the sense of how important it was to him to keep that tradition going. Right, even in his last days, right, he was clearly very sick and frail, but he began the Ango, right? And so we're going to be celebrating the anniversary, and because of physical limitations, we've invited those who, and hope to have among mostly the active students. And that's going to be a wonderful celebration. And I wanted to read, I've been talking about this narrative that we started some months ago. Shoban, one of our students, has really been instrumental in helping to make that happen. Because I wanted to, for people coming in like today, or those of you who started coming here a week ago or a month ago, and you walk in and you look around and you think, wow, okay, there's this, and there's a Sangha house, and there's a Jizo house, and if you go out back, you'll see we have two electric cars, and, you know, we have heat, and, you know, all this good stuff. It wasn't always like that. It was not like that in the beginning. And so I thought, how to convey that? Why? You know, it's not just I had to walk to school in the cold, barefooted, you know, and you don't know what it's like. I mean, a little bit of that. But for appreciation, to appreciate both what we have, right, which makes practice here, you know, in many ways easier. And there's a downside to that. When things are too easy, we forget. We can become a little lazy. Not intentionally. It's just kind of our nature, you know. And so we try not to make things too comfortable. But to understand who was here in the beginning, what was it like? What did they have to do? How did this possibly happen? And so Yushin, who was Dada Roshi's wife at the time, and their young son, Asian, I'm just going to pull a little bit from part of her narrative. And to her, we owe a great debt because she was so important in those early years in so many ways. And she talked about how in January of 1980, the three of them came to this property. They were looking for a place to start, establish an art center that would be, you know, engaged in Zen practice. That was Dada Roshi's original vision. And a friend of theirs told them about this place, so they came here. It was a dreary, cold January day. The place was dark. Nobody was here. It was late in the day. They decided to come back later. They came back a few days later. It was a much warmer day. It was brighter, so they came in, and they started looking around. She tells the story of how they walked around the back, and Dada Roshi, who was raised Catholic and trained by Jesuit monks, school, saw the risen Christ on the back, and just said, "What place is this?" And then he saw this man sitting out in the field. And he said to Yushin, "I'm going to go check, who is that guy? I'm going to go see if he can let us in." So they went up there and introduced themselves, and it was Harold Har, who was the patriarch, I'd have to say. He's kind of the patriarch of their family, in the best way, right? He owned this place and ran it as a Lutheran camp with his large family, who was very involved in this place, and they were looking to sell it. And there were lots of people who wanted to buy it and do all kinds of things with this. And so Dada Roshi sat down, and they started to have a conversation. Yushin took Asian, who was too young and squirmy to tolerate an adult conversation, and they walked all over the place for 2 hours. While they talked, and eventually she came back and she said, "We're tired, we need to go." So they stood up, Dido and Harold shook hands, and then as they were walking back, they were silent. They got into their borrowed car, and then Dido turned to her and said, "I just bought a monastery." And she said, quote, "Wait, what the hell? You bought it? With what? How are you going to do that?" And he said, "I'm not sure yet." And she said, "Well, what do you mean? How are we going to do this? How can we do this?" And he said, "We'll figure it out." He said, "Yushin, we'll work it out." I mean, that's chutzpah. But it's a lot more than that. It's love for the Dharma. It's devotion. It's not just a personal devotion to the Dharma. Somebody who just has that is a fine practitioner. But they don't undertake something which is going to be incredibly arduous and difficult and present unimaginable complications and challenges with very little to start with. Somebody doesn't do that just out of a personal devotion to their own practice. They only do that kind of madness, because they understand how immeasurably powerful and transformative this path can be for those who seek. And that kind of bodhisattva vow being manifest, that heart, that desire, that courage. And she goes on to say, Yushin, Dido's meeting with Harold Har on that long ago January day had not been prearranged. She said, "If we hadn't made the return trip to Mount Tremper so quickly after that first visit, if we had delayed returning for another week or more, if we hadn't run into Harold on that day, he may well have sold the property to somebody else for luxury condos, for a gourmet restaurant. I mean, we've had offers on the place. And there have been people who wanted to tear it down and start something fresh." She said, "The whole thing was meant to be. It was part of Dido's karma from the day he was born." And you know, that can seem fanciful. Buddhism doesn't believe in destiny, that things are preordained. But it does believe that we have lived many lifetimes, and that we have established currents, dispositions, tendencies, potentials within ourselves. And whether you believe in rebirth or not, my mother said, me and my three siblings were not born into this world as blank slates. She said, we were born with personalities. So however you want to explain that, Dada Roshi was definitely born with a personality. He had a big one. And so to think of how somebody from the very beginning could be predisposed, right? And then would need to have to nurture that and have that nurtured. And so to think of what Dogen was able to do, right? And to have such a stature this time, but he didn't do that alone. He had enormous help and support from not very many people, actually. He did not have one of these 1,500, 1,000, even 5. He had a very small community. Dadarushi, if it were not for him, we would not be here. But he did not do that by himself. Not by a long shot. What happens here is not done by any one person. That's the way it has been and needs to be. And that continues today and beyond. And so in that way, Ango, you know, if we can appreciate how this is important for our own training, the alleviation of suffering in our own lives, the living of our vows so that we bring that to others in every way that we can, and to appreciate that that is part of something larger. And the larger of that, for the most part, we don't know. I don't know. You don't know. When people would try and get Dado to predict, what do you think is going to be going on in 5 years, 10 years? He would not bite that hook. He said, I don't know. He said, I don't tell fortunes. He said, but if we plant seeds now, good seeds, and those seeds are based in seeds planted yesterday and the day before, and we keep nurturing that garden, we don't have to worry about and pretend to know what's going to happen in a few years. When we get there, we will have cultivated that garden, so we will know what to do. And so I see this as very much, it's so much more important than, you know, the particulars, which are very important. Because that's the stuff of it, right? That's the detail of it. And so with all of that, let us begin, right? And take, you know, in whatever, I mean, some of you are maybe here for the first time and are just getting an earful, right? But for those of us who know what we're talking about, what this is, and wherever you are, right, even whether you're participating formally in Ango or not, the whole point of it is to help you, to help you. And so in whatever way, this day, whatever way Ango can help you, let it help you. But it's not a thing. It's not going to come knock on your door and say, let me help you. It's not going to get you up in the morning and say, come, I prepared your seat. It's not going to do that. It's not an it, right? It's better than that. It's you. I'll end with Dogen. Though there are many aspects of the secular life and the religious life, we only recognize and understand what the power of our penetrating vision can reach. In order to appreciate the 10,000 dharmas, we should know that although they may look round or square, the other qualities of oceans and mountains are infinite in variety. Furthermore, other universes lie in all quarters. However things appear, and whether you're thinking of, you know, decidedly dharma, in the Dharma realm, or whether you're thinking of things decidedly in the realm of politics or government or societies or earth. What Dogen is saying is, although they may look one way, they have other qualities that are actually infinite in variety. And it is so not only around ourselves, but also directly here, even in a drop of water. And so let us practice very directly upon the ground on which we stand, and at the same time hold the immensity of the whole thing, this whole universe, this whole mind of Buddha, this whole Sangha. And in that way, we don't have to worry about the next 3 months, right? You don't have to worry about Chuso Hosen. We take care of today, And we can trust that because we also are holding a larger vision. Right? So let's do some good.
Thank you for listening. To find out more about ZMM's programs, retreats, and residency, please visit us online at zmm.org.